to make a good throw that second service.
I wanted to make sure they got it.
Yeah. It wasn't close. Anyway, kind of reminded me of that Rose Bowl a couple years ago. We're not going to talk about that. Being a Texan and all, I had a good time with that one. Anyway, a great way to... oh! Great way to start off this morning. Well, I'm just glad to be back with you. It's been a few years. I appreciate Jack having me back. And I'm always surprised when a politician gets invited anywhere the first time, let alone the second time. I don't know about here. Back in Texas, politicians don't have the most popular profession. When I first got elected to the legislature back there, I remember I was kind of feeling like that kid in Sunday school class, you know, that teacher says, "Who in here wants to go to heaven?" And, of course, everybody raises their hand, except little Johnny over there in the corner. Teacher says, "Well, Johnny, don't you want to go to heaven?" He looked around the room. He said, "Not with this bunch." You know, kind of how I felt when I got to the house. I guess I was, you know, standing there. I was getting sworn in. My wife and my one son at the time, and mom and dad, my pastor. Everybody's there. Maybe it's because my pastor was there. I don't know. But that night, I had a dream that he and I arrived in heaven at the exact same time. And we're getting a little tour, and we're going around. And St. Peter says to my pastor, he says, "This will be your home here in heaven." He points over this little shack. I mean, it's just a little one bedroom thing, little cot, little desk. And I'm thinking, man, the preacher's getting that. I'm in trouble. But we go around the corner. There's a big, huge mansion. Gold pillars, you know, all the stuff. And as a kid, you think heaven's supposed to be, right? Well, see this big mansion. He says, "Rick, this is your home." I said, "Well, wait. Why does that good and holy man over there get that little shack, and you're giving me this big mansion?" He said, "Well, you hadn't been here long." He said, "You don't know how it works." He said, "Man, we got all the preachers up here we want." He said, "You're the first politician ever made it. So we thought we'd kind of make this a little better." I don't know, you know, I shouldn't joke. I mean, we should respect and honor our leaders. But I think we do get cynical, and we get cynical because too often we see politicians who are thinking about the next election instead of patriots thinking about the next generation. And that's what we long for. We long for that type of leadership that's saying, "It's not about me, it's about the next generation." Servant-style leadership saying, "I'm going to do the right thing because it's the right thing to do, even if it costs me an election." And we're looking for that. You know, that's the type of attitude that founded this nation, this attitude of saying, "It's not about me, it's about the next generation." Now, I want to try to take us back a little bit into the founding of our country because, you know, it's so important for us to think about what made our nation great. If you think about America, this is where true freedom began. I mean, before 1776... true freedom had not existed for any nation. You had attempts. I mean, you had the Romans, the Greeks had bits and pieces of certain types of freedom. The British had attempts, but no one had true freedom for their people until 1776 here on this continent. And when you go back and you look at where we came from, you begin to realize what is important for us to hold on to, what revolutionary strategies that our founding fathers put in place that made us the most successful nation in the world, and how do we hold on to those principles and pass them to our children to make sure that freedom survives in America. Woodrow Wilson said, "A nation which does not know what it was yesterday does not know what it is today, nor what it's trying to do." We're trying to do a futile thing if we do not know where we came from or what we've been about. So we want to go back and say, what made it successful? How do we hold on to that and continue to make this the greatest nation in the history of the world? Well, if you think about the birth of freedom, it is not that different from actual birth. I mean, you mamas out there know that life does not begin on the day of birth, right? The stork doesn't fly by and drop the baby. I mean, that life began long before that point. It had to be nurtured within the womb, had to develop within the womb. Well, the birth of freedom is exactly the same way. Does not happen in a vacuum. Doesn't happen overnight. For decades, literally for centuries, before freedom was birthed here on this continent, the seeds had to be developed. They had to be planted. They had to be nurtured. They had to be watered. They had to develop. And all of the conditions, just like real birth, had to be exactly right for that birth to occur. Well, the seeds were planted here in America by those pilgrims. And when they came here and they planted those seeds, it's interesting when you look at that painting that I know Jack's seen a dozen times there in the rotunda at the U.S. Capitol. If you ever get a chance to visit, go into that rotunda. There's 8 paintings in there. And you'll see that painting of the pilgrims. Get up real close and you'll notice the Bible that they're studying from there is a Geneva Bible. And what was so special to the pilgrims about that Geneva Bible, the text was not that different from King James, but the commentaries in the margins from those great reformers where they were speaking out against the divine right of kings, which you can imagine as a king, that's a pretty good deal. I mean, whatever you say, that's God speaking through you. It's not such a great deal for the rest of us. But these guys were speaking out against that. And the pilgrims began to take these concepts of freedom and free enterprise, representative government, work ethic, personal responsibility, and they began to plant those seeds here on this continent. The seeds began to grow and be nurtured and develop. And John Adams actually said that it was the pastors that came along that actually started watering those seeds. He said men like Mayhew and Cooper and Whitfield, they were the reason that you and I enjoy the freedom we have today. That they were the ones that developed and nurtured those seeds so that freedom could be birthed in 1776. And he said without them, it never would have occurred. Well, then you started to get, after the seeds had been planted, they'd been watered, you began to get there in the womb of America, if you will, kind of the first little flutters. You mama's got to know, we daddies get a little jealous about those flutters. We can't feel them. I mean, we try all day, you just can't tell. You're the only one that gets to enjoy that. Well, the flutters within the womb of America were guys like Sam Adams and Benjamin Harrison starting those committees of correspondence. And those committees of correspondence led to that first Continental Congress there in 1774. But the kicks that everyone could begin to notice, the kicks within the womb of America from liberty, began on March 23rd, 1775, with this guy right here, Patrick Henry. Now, what had happened was the Virginia House of Burgesses had been disbanded by his royal governor. And these guys had all gotten together anyway, there at St. John's Church. And Patrick Henry sat back and he listened to the others as they got up one by one and talked about how it was not right for Virginia to join the fight, that just couldn't happen. We could not possibly beat the mother country and just couldn't do it. And one by one, they're getting up talking about, wringing their hands, how it can't be done. He sits back and he listens. Has all he can handle. And finally, he rises and he starts off by saying, "An appeal to arms and to the God of hosts is all that is left us. They tell us, sir, that we are weak, unable to withstand so formidable an adversary. But when shall we be stronger? Will it be next week or next year? Will it be when we have been totally disarmed and a British guard shall be stationed in every house? Shall we gather strength through irresolution or inaction? We are not weak, sir, if we make a proper use of those means which the God of nature hath placed in our power. 3 millions of people armed in the holy cause of liberty and in such a nation as that which we possess are invincible to any force which our enemy can send against us. Besides, sir, we shall not fight our battles alone. There is a just God who presides over the destinies of nation and who will raise up friends to fight our battles for us. The battle, sir, is not to the strong alone. It is to the vigilant, the active, the brave. Gentlemen may cry peace, peace, but there is no peace. The war has actually begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north will bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. Our brethren are already in the field. Why stand we here idle? What is it that gentlemen wish? What would they have? Is life so dear or are peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take. But as for me, give me liberty or give me death." It was... I wish I could write things like that. The next gale that sweeps. Anyway, all right. It was 3 weeks later that shot heard around the world was fired there at Lexington. And we were literally at a place then where all of the conditions were perfectly aligned for the birth of freedom to occur. With the cry of Jefferson's pen and the pledge of those other 55 guys that signed the Declaration of Independence, right here on this continent, freedom was born. She was very delicate for a while there. I mean, you think about it. We spent our infancy, our freedom was in its infancy, literally at war with the greatest military power on the planet. We didn't know for years whether or not we would succeed. We were teetering between resounding defeat or glorious victory. We finally did emerge victorious there at Yorktown. And even after that, we spent that first decade of independence just kind of crawling along and not taking those first steps until 1787 with our new constitution. But even then, we did not have true freedom for all of our citizens until 75 years later with Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. But you take it from that date, you fast forward to where we are today, we have literally become what President Reagan referred to as the shining city on a hill. It's what Winthrop had dreamed this would become 400 years ago. We have set the example. We have more economic prosperity, more scientific advancement. We have the most incredible military in the history of the world, most powerful nation on the face of the planet. We have loosened the chains of tyranny, the shackles of tyranny off of millions and millions of people around the world, defeating communism, Nazism, despotism. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. That military power always being used to free and liberate people. We never use it to conquer and subdue others. But when you come to the day and you say, hey, let's kind of take a checkup. Let's look at the health of America. You have to be honest and say it's not all perfect. I mean, we've kind of got some infirmities. We've got some illnesses, if you will. And there's some problem areas. And you think about what's happening in our culture and you take a good assessment. You say, well, on one hand, yeah, we're the most economically successful ever. I mean, the poorest people in America live better than kings did 200 years ago. We've got more wealth, all of these things. But at the same time, you think about our economic prosperity, our families are falling apart. You say, how does that happen? You look on one hand and you say, we've got all this scientific advancement. We're the most enlightened period, supposedly. We know more about the brain and sociology. And we've got all of our studies and all of our ivory tower elites and all of that. And yet at the same time, our children are murdering each other at school. So something is amiss. Something is wrong with that foundation. If you say, well, we became the most successful nation in the world, but you know, something's happening to that foundation, to those principles. What is it that is changing within there? And I would suggest to you today that the reason that we've got these changes, we have politicians now that, as we mentioned earlier, are putting their own career ahead of what is good for the state of the nation. I mean, you realize this is the first time in our nation's history we actually have elected representatives in Washington, D.C. that have hitched their wagon to defeat. They'd rather see us lose so they can hold on to political power. That's never happened in our history before. You think about what the courts are doing to undermine our traditional values and to begin to remove God from the public square. They've been chipping away at it for 40 years and made tremendous progress in trying to move us towards a secular nation. But I would lay most of the blame not at those institutions, folks, but at our feet, that we the people do not recognize or remember the source of our strength, that we do not honor the source of that strength and keep it at the forefront of who we are. So there's a lot of issues that we need to be addressing in our culture today. I hope you're glad you came today to get depressed. Now, let me kind of put you at ease. This is not going to be a doom and gloom message, okay? I know a lot of people travel around the country and tell you how bad it is, that, you know, they're the kind of people that can just light up the room by leaving, you know? That my friend in San Marcos, Texas, Dr. Jarvis, he says they got mental B.O. You know, they're weaned on a pickle. I mean, it's just we're not going to do that, though. All right. We're going to instead say, hey, what is right with our country? What is right with our founding? And how do we return to those principles? But we do have to be honest in our assessment of where we are as a country and say, what can we do to preserve what our founding fathers gave us and keep this nation great? To do that, we've got to say, what is the true source of our strength? You know, I think the terrorists get this backwards. I mean, they seem to think that America's real strength is when you look at our architectural wonders. And so they tend to attack us there. Or they say, you know, it's our military, our economic institutions and our free market system. All of that is great. And it's part of what has made us the most successful nation in the world. But even our resolve and our strength is not to be found just in our military power and our places like the Pentagon. That's where they tend to want to attack. Now, if you really want to understand the strength of America, the real underlying strength that made all of those things so great, you can simply go to that quote that's been attributed to Alexis de Tocqueville. When he said, when he came and he looked for what had made us so great, he said, I sought for the key to the greatness and genius of America in her harbors and ample rivers, in her fertile fields and boundless forests, in her rich mines and vast world commerce, in her public school system and institutions of learning. I sought for it in her Democratic Congress and in her matchless Constitution. Not until I went into the churches of America and heard her pulpits aflame with righteousness did I understand the secret of her genius and power. America is great because America is good. And if America ever ceases to be good, America will cease to be great. The very foundation of what made our nation great, the value system, came from the pulpit. It came from us, we the people, listening to what the pastor was teaching us on Sunday morning and then taking it out into the culture and making sure that every area of the culture, whether it's business or politics or the media, the arts, all of those things, that they reflected that worldview, that reflected that biblical worldview, and they took God's principles and moved them into every area of the culture. But we have to get back to that source first, recognizing that our freedom came from Him and honoring Him for that, and then making sure the system reflects that. Chief Justice John Jay, first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, he put it this way. He said the most effectual means of securing the continuance of our civil and religious liberties. Notice he's not just saying religious. So this isn't just so that we can worship the way we want on Sunday or pray at home. He's talking about civil and religious. So all of our liberties, all of our freedoms, the most effectual means of securing those is always to remember with reverence and gratitude the source from which they flow. Simply saying, if our freedom comes from God, not from government, not from our neighbor, not from each other. If our freedom comes from God, we must exercise that freedom with a respect for the authority of God. We must honor that source of freedom. That's how we preserve this for the next generation. If you and I are going to do our job on during our opportunity to stand guard at the Watchtower of Freedom, number one, we've got to honor the source. John Adams put it this way. He said, "The safety and prosperity of nations ultimately and essentially depend on the protection and blessing of Almighty God." The national acknowledgement of this truth. You notice he didn't say when we go home and pray in our prayer closet. He didn't say when we get in our church and privately together we pray. He's saying the national acknowledgement, that's corporately, publicly as a nation acknowledging this truth, is not only an indispensable duty which the people owe to him, but a duty whose natural influence is favorable to the promotion of that morality and piety without which social happiness cannot exist, nor the blessings of a free government be enjoyed. So we're not going to enjoy the freedom of having this incredible system of government that we have. We're not going to enjoy our own personal social happiness in our communities if we do not nationally acknowledge the blessings of God and how much we are dependent upon His blessings. That's the way the Founding Fathers told us to do it. It's the way we used to do it for the first 170 years of our history, but the last 60 years we've been trying to remove it. We say no prayer in our public schools, case called Engle v. Vitale, no Bible in our public schools, Abington v. Shemp, Murray v. Collette was the case. We say no prayer at our football games even. Just a girl getting up and praying for the guys out on the field, saying, "God protect them, keep them from getting hurt somehow." That's an establishment of a national denomination in America. We're not going to allow that. We say the Ten Commandments can't be on a wall in the school. Court was very specific in this case called Stone v. Graham. They said if you put the Ten Commandments on the wall in a school, the kids might see them. He said if they see them, why, they might read them. And if they read them, they might study them. And if they study them, they might obey them. And that would violate the Establishment Clause. So we don't want them to study and obey. They'll say, don't kill, don't steal. No, that's a bad idea. We wouldn't want to make sure that. I mean, think about it. What we've done instead of having those moral absolutes and saying this is what we want reflected in our culture, we've done two major things different in our culture today, in our education system. We've said, number one, there's no right and wrong. There's no moral absolutes. You know, it might be wrong for me. Doesn't mean it's wrong for you. Moral relativism for all. You do whatever's right in your own eyes. And oh, by the way, while you're at it, that student you're sitting next to, just randomly gathered protoplasm. They're just an accident. They're not a child of God. They're not a created being. They're just an accident. You do whatever you think is right. And we're shocked that they can walk into a classroom, take out a gun, and murder their classmates. Friends, we put a formula in place that says don't respect life. Do whatever you think is right. And then we learn about Paducah, Pearl, Jonesboro, Littleton. The list goes on. You know, in February, we had 4 school shootings. In 1 month, 4 school shootings. We don't even read about them in most of our newspapers because it's just not even news anymore unless it's as bad as Virginia Tech. Didn't happen 50 years ago. Guns were easier to get 50 years ago than they are today. I mean, I can put my 40 caliber Glock up here and we can all stand around it and chant all day long. It's not going to jump up and shoot anybody. So the gun's not the problem. What's the problem? The heart of man, right? We're changing. We're changing our value system and what we teach our young people. We get a different result in the culture. Well, of course, now we say even the Pledge of Allegiance, according to the Ninth Circus Court of Appeals. A few of y'all got that one. Is supposedly unconstitutional because it's got under God in it. We've got these crazy cases. You hear about them all the time. And I don't want to repeat too much of what we did when I was here 3 or 4 years ago. But, you know, these cases like Doe v. Santa Fe. I mean, this one I'm embarrassed to say comes from the great state of Texas. But in this particular case, we were dealing with prayer to graduation, not by a speaker or a pastor. It was just a student that was going to pray. And the court said they would allow her to pray, but only if she did not mention the name of Christ. You know, and 2 years ago, what happened over in Nevada, you had the valedictorian speech and the girl was going to mention her faith in Christ as part of her speech. And they shut the microphone off on her, wouldn't even allow her to utter the words Jesus Christ. You know, this year we had this last year we had a graduation where a girl mentioned her faith in Christ in her valedictorian speech. And the school made her publicly apologize before she could get her diploma for mentioning the name of Christ at a public school graduation. Folks, we've come a long way from our history. Now, a lot of people will tell you the Founding Fathers were not Christians. That's the way they wanted it to be. And so we've had this consistent effort to try to remove the faith of our founders. But they were so clear about it. I mean, John Adams said the general principles upon which the founders achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity. So the basic principles upon which the nation were built were the principles of Christianity. Yet we're not even supposed to mention his name. So if you want to know the truth about the faith of the founders, lots of good materials out on the table. The very talk I did here 3 years ago. We'll go through detail by detail, and we try to cover as many of those founders as possible just to answer that question of whether or not they were men of faith and whether or not they wanted that faith to be part of our public life. I'm going to repeat two stories from that that one just to, for those of you that weren't here, to try to drive this home. Number one happened in 1774. This was the opening session of Congress, September 7th, when these guys got together. The very first time that our United States Congress meets, take a look at what they're doing there. These atheist founding fathers were having a little time on their knees in prayer. All right. And not only did they kneel and pray. In fact, what happened was one of the guys got up and he said, "Hey, you know, we ought to have a prayer." Another guy said, No, wait. We've got every denomination possible in this room. How could we pray?" Samuel Adams, father of the American Revolution, gets up. He says, "I'm no bigot. I can pray with every man in this room. Let's pray." They began to pray. They brought in the Reverend Jacob Deshaies and they prayed for 3 hours. 3 hours of prayer and a Bible study. See that guy right there? That's John Adams again. He said, he wrote home to Abigail, said, "Abigail, God so spoke to us out of Psalms 35, we believe for the first time we could defeat the British." He said, "Tell everybody back home, study Psalms 35. Prayer and a Bible study by a bunch of supposed atheists there in Congress. But instead of going through all these guys, I do want to tell you, remind you about one guy, Benjamin Franklin, because both sides tend to agree this is one of our least religious founding fathers. Now, that's unusual just to agree. I mean, you can imagine the ACLU and I are not on the same page most of the time. But this is one place we do agree. Benjamin Franklin is one of our least religious founding fathers. Now, here he is at the convention. He's 81 years old at the Constitutional Convention. Now 81, I used to think that was old back when I had as much hair as Jack. But it's starting to sound a little younger. But my former congressman, the congressman that I grew up with, who's still in Congress, a guy named Ralph Hall from Rockwall, Texas, he and I were speaking at an event together. And he gets up, he's going first, he gets up, he looks over at me. He says, "Rick, I used to think that 81 was old." He said, I just turned 81 a week ago, whatever it was. He said, "But I went to Senator Strom Thurmond's 100-year birthday party." He said, "Senator Thurmond looks over at me and he says, 'Oh, to be 80 again, you know.'" So my point is, 81's not a big deal today, all right? But back in the founding era, the average lifespan was 35. So here's Benjamin Franklin, 81 at the Constitutional Convention. He's the elder statesman, man. When he speaks, everybody's going to listen. Well, he rises to give his longest speech of the convention on June 28, 1787. Now, this is the point in the convention. If you read all the journals, this is a place where it looked like the whole thing was going to fall apart. No agreement. Everybody's going to go home. So Franklin gets up, elder statesman. He starts off by saying this. He says, "In the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for divine protection." Now, he's at the Constitutional Convention saying this. See, he's one of only 6 guys to sign both the Constitution and the Declaration. So at the Constitutional Convention, he's able to stand up and say to everybody else in the room, "Listen, I was in this same room a decade ago. We didn't have a chance. We were taking on the greatest military and the power in the world. We had to have God on our side or we would not succeed." He went on to say, "Our prayers were heard and they were graciously answered. All of us engaged in the struggle must have observed frequent instances of a superintending providence in our favor." And then he asked a question really all of us need to ask today. He said, "Have we now forgotten this powerful friend? Or do we imagine we no longer need his assistance? I've lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth that God governs in the affairs of men. You know this part of us: sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice. Is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We've been assured in the sacred writings that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. I firmly believe this, and I also believe without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and his blessing on our deliberation be held in this assembly every morning before we proceed to business." He's calling these guys to prayer, not just once. He's saying we need to do this every day, a public expression of faith. This is our least religious founding father. Man, he sounds like a Bible-thumping evangelical, doesn't he? I mean, this is not a private expression of faith. This is a public expression of faith. This is why we're going to get together on Thursday all across the country and have the National Day of Prayer. Because publicly, corporately, we're coming together and asking for God's blessing on our nation. The founders did this over and over again. We can show you proclamation after proclamation we have in our collection at Wobblers, where presidents and governors called on the nation. And I mean, they were serious about it. They called on for days of prayer, fasting, and humiliation. And they talked in those proclamations about how they hoped everyone would come to know Christ as their Savior. I mean, there was just no question about where they were on this. And they thought it was very important to have that public expression of faith. So very quickly, we want to make sure if we're going to protect freedom, number one, that we all do our part and we hold our elected officials accountable in doing their part to honor the source of where our freedom came from. Second thing we've got to do to protect freedom is honor sacrifice. honor those that have come before us to preserve the freedom that we have. You know, we're told in Scripture that we're to render honor unto whom honor is due. Now, I can't think of anyone that is more honorable and more due that honor than those who are also willing to lay down their lives for their friends, in this case, for their fellow countrymen. These people that are willing to give everything for us to be able to be free. In addition to the young corporal that's headed back, could we get everybody that has served in the military or is serving us now to please stand? Let's just thank you and honor you for the sacrifice that you and your families have made. We appreciate you guys. Thank you guys so much. And actually, can we do something else? Those of you that have lost a loved one in the military serving for us, would you stand and let us thank you because we want to honor your sacrifice as well. Thank you very much. Thank you. This is real stuff, folks. It's not Pollyanna. It's not, you know, just theory. This is real stuff, and it takes real sacrifice to enjoy the freedom that we have. We're so spoiled in our country. We just don't realize what it takes. I used to think my generation was may or may not be up to the task. I wasn't sure, but man, when I watch these guys and gals that are serving us now, it just gets me excited to realize that we have in every generation of Americans enough of those that are willing to pay that price, and we need to honor them and thank them for what they do. I guess since I'm in Los Angeles, I got to use a little bit of Hollywood to make my point here. But there's a couple of movies I want to point out. All right? This movie, first of all, The Patriot with Mel Gibson. I was so excited when this movie came out because Mel Gibson was going to be the Patriot, you know. And here we were. I was in my first term as a state representative back in Texas, and we went opening night. I mean, it was, you know, packed house, and my wife was on my right and her parents. And 15 minutes into the movie, we find out Mel Gibson's character in the movie is a state representative. So naturally, I'm getting excited. You know, I'm nudging my wife saying, "Hey, baby, Mel Gibson, state representative. Your husband, state representative." You know, kind of hoping for some confusion there. But anyway, it was a great movie, because what happened in that movie is we learned the value of sacrifice. Hollywood does a superb job in 2 hours. You sit down, you get up 2 hours later after the music and the drama, and a value has been instilled. Most of the time, not one what we really want, right? Or want our young people. In this case, the value was the value of sacrifice, saying it's not about me, it's about the next generation. I'm willing to sacrifice that they may have freedom. And I think that's something that you and I have got to adopt. We've got to recognize that not only those that serve us in the military, willing to give their lives and shed their blood, but all of us have to be willing to sacrifice some of our lives, some of our fortunes, some of our honor to be able to go out there and engage in the culture. My wife's grandfather got his Purple Heart there at Iwo Jima, and I love from Flags of Our Fathers the quote that Bradley gives from one of the two monuments there. He said, "When you go home, tell them for us and say, 'For your tomorrow, we gave our today.'" That's what these soldiers right now serving us around the world are willing to do. They're willing to give their today so that our nation will have a tomorrow, so that our children and our grandchildren will get to enjoy this freedom. The other movie I want to mention is Saving Private Ryan. I know most people have seen it, but there's this scene at the end of that movie that I think drives this point home better than any other. Of course, you know the story. Tom Hanks' character, Captain Miller, has been commissioned with getting Private Ryan back home because his brothers have all been killed in action. They're trying to get him back home safely. At the end of the movie, Tom Hanks' character sacrifices his life to try to accomplish this mission. But just before he dies, he grabs that young Private Ryan and he pulls him close and he says two words. He says, "Earn this." And then that scene morphs from that young Private Ryan to an elderly Private Ryan 50, 60 years later. And he's standing or kneeling there at the grave of Captain Miller. And he says, "I hope that I have lived a life worthy of the sacrifice you made for me." Friends, you and I need to live lives worthy, live out our freedom in a way that honors the sacrifice of those that have come before us and preserve this freedom that we get to enjoy. I hope you'll think about that when you go vote. Think about it whenever you get involved in any way, that part of what you're doing is honoring the ones that came before us. President Lincoln put it this way: "It is from these honored dead that we take increased devotion to the cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. That we highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth." I want to sidetrack just for a minute here and talk for a second about these men and women serving us right now, because this is different. This war on terror is very different. And, you know, I hear pundits saying it's not a popular war and all this stuff. Let's step back and look in the context of history. Instead of just looking at today, let's look at the history of our nation. I was doing a radio program with David Barton. We've got a daily show called Wall Builders Live, and we talk about things going on in the culture, try to address them from a historical point of view and a biblical point of view. And you might remember the congressman from Minnesota, Muslim from Minnesota, Ellison, that was elected to Congress in 06, and he was sworn in on the Quran instead of the Bible. So a lot of people were calling and asking us about it, so we did a show about it. And he had made a big deal, this congressman, about Thomas Jefferson having a Quran, that Jefferson was heavily influenced by the Quran. So we're doing the show, and David's answering the question, why did Jefferson have a Quran? And he says, well, Rick, of course, this is not our first war on terror. And here we are on the air. And I said, no, of course not, David. Why don't you tell us about that first war on terror? Because I didn't have a clue what he was talking about. All right, some of y'all probably know, but he was talking about the very first war on terror, which was against the Barbary powers. And we literally fought for 32 years radical Islamic terrorism, very much like what we're dealing with at this point. These guys believed that they had a spiritual reward for killing the infidel. And one of the ambassadors that we had dealt with actually told Thomas Jefferson that in some of the negotiations that were going on. What had happened was we were literally fighting these guys for all these years, and you had four presidents. This went on for a long time. Washington couldn't do much about it. Didn't have a navy. He couldn't go fight. They were capturing our sailors, capturing our ships and American citizen sailors and ransoming them back to us. Washington was literally spending 16% of the federal budget paying those ransoms off. Adams spent 19% of the federal budget paying those ransoms off. And Jefferson, when he gets in office, he says, no more. We're not paying any more. We're going to war. Now he had a Navy, and now he had the Marines. And Corporal and you other Marines, you know exactly what we're talking about here, because it says in your hymn, it says, the shores of Tripoli, right? That's what this was all about. He sends them in. We fight. It takes a long time. We finally win. We get a 150-year peace dividend as a result of what they did and winning that first war on radical Islamic terrorism. But see, Jefferson understood, because he had been studying the Quran, studying his enemy. He understands. They believe they have a spiritual reward for killing us. So the ambassador told him, we believe we have the right to attack any nation that considers itself a Christian nation and kill any of those that we capture. So he knew he couldn't just negotiate, that they had to be defeated. A friend of mine, I think, puts this better than anybody else when you put it in perspective. His name's Colonel Brian Birdwell. He was the closest survivor, if you're not familiar with his story, closest survivor to the point of impact there at the Pentagon. He literally was covered in jet fuel, his whole body burned, believed that he would not survive. He's had 39 surgeries, just a miraculous, miraculous story. Now travels the country sharing his testimony, but amazing story. He's actually a very funny guy, too, because it's such a tense story. You need the comic relief. But I mean, he will be in the middle of telling you exactly what's happening. He's talking about, you know, lying there. He can smell his own flesh burning. He knows he's about to die. Says goodbye to his wife and son in his own way. Cries out and says, Jesus, I'm coming home. And he said, I was expecting at any moment to hear God say, well done, thy good and faithful servant. But he said, God must have a sense of humor, because I just kind of laid there and got a little more well done. And it's a lot better coming from him. But anyway, and he will tell you, after all those surgeries, he says, you know, I don't look that bad for a guy that got run over by a 757. You know, I mean, but incredible guy, incredible story. But Colonel Birdwell was on the radio program one day, and he said, Rick, here's what you got to understand. He said, when we were fighting the Soviets, at least as atheists, they wanted to live. He said, the enemy we fight today, they define victory as death. He said, that's a totally different war. He said, you got to understand, this is not going to end overnight. This is a generational war. And so it becomes even more important for you and I to honor the sacrifice of those that are fighting for us, because too often the media and the general public is not going to do that. And let's you and I make it a commitment on our part that this will not be like Vietnam when they come home, that we are going to thank them and honor them and appreciate them. So I don't care if you're in the airport or where you are, you see somebody in uniform, pat them on the back, shake their hand, say, God bless you and thank you for your service. I go ahead. Yeah. I know I started off with a dig about the Rose Bowl, but let me tell you, I'm proud of my fellow Texans in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, because a lot of the troops come home to that DFW airport. And I'm telling you, they come in hundreds every day from all over the Metroplex at the airport, and they do a victory line for these soldiers coming home. And they walk down that victory line, they give them flowers and hugs and kisses and letters and thank them, and it's phenomenal. There's not a dry eye in the room. It's just that's the kind of thing we all need to be doing in our own way every time that we can. Honor the sacrifice of those who came before us. So number one, we're going to honor the source of the freedom that we have. Number two, we're going to honor the sacrifice of those that came before us to preserve this freedom. And then, of course, it's up to us. We must do our duty. And the question is, what is your duty? What have you been called to do in order to preserve freedom for the next generation? What is your specific part? Do you have to run for office? Do you have to be a politician? You know, you're probably thinking, oh, Lord, please, no, don't put me in that category. You know, I consider myself a recovering politician. I go to a Tuesday night meeting every week, and we get up and say, you know, hi, I'm Rick. I'm a recovering politician, and I'm 6 years clean off the ballot at this point. So just so y'all know. Anyway, you don't have to be a politician. You don't have to be a billionaire, but you do have to take action. Remember what Patrick Henry told us? He said, it's not to the strong alone. It's to the vigilant, the active, the brave. So you and I have to find ways to take action in a small way every day to participate in this process and preserve that freedom. When they changed the world with those 56 words found on the heart of the Declaration, they let us know it's consent of the governed. Nothing happens to government that is not a reflection of us. We have a responsibility to hold them accountable. And when you think about what they did when they came in that room to launch freedom, man, this was treason. They were committing treason against the mother country. They believed they were signing a death warrant. In fact, Benjamin Rush wrote later to John Adams, he said, do you remember what it was like when we gathered to sign what we believed would be our death warrant? He said, everybody came in the room and no one said a word. He said, they all came in and they sat down, total silence, and Secretary Thompson began to call them forward. Now, this was, let me mesh up your history this morning. This was not July 4th, okay? July 4th, Hancock signs and Secretary Thompson, but nobody else. A month later, on August 2nd, everybody else comes in. And Thompson, there at the front of the room, he's got the Declaration, silver ink, well, two feather pens. You can still go see it at Independence Hall. He starts on his right, and he calls the delegation from New Hampshire. He starts with Josiah Bartlett of New Hampshire. Bartlett gets up, comes forward, takes out that pen, dips it in the ink, and signs the Declaration of Independence in total silence. Goes back, sits down. One by one, they come. John Hart of New Jersey. And Hart gets up, comes forward, takes the pen out. You can hear it scratching along the surface of the Declaration of Independence. Nobody says anything until Elbridge Gerry is called forward. Now, how many of y'all have heard of Elbridge Gerry? He's not a very popular founding father. I got one there. I mean, he went on to become vice president, but not well known. This is all you need to know about him for this particular story. Elbridge Gerry was the smallest founding father. He's a little bitty guy. He was not the towering, you know, 7 foot Hulk Hogan type specimen that stands before you speaking this morning. What are you guys laughing at? Come on. We've all got dreams or delusions, whatever you call it. Anyway, okay, he was even smaller than me, okay, little bitty guy. And this little guy gets up, and he's going to sign the Declaration of Independence. And from the back of the room, the largest of the founders, Colonel Benjamin Harrison, you saw a picture of him earlier. Colonel Harrison, I mean, this guy's huge. He's big enough. I mean, this guy could have been a middle linebacker. He big enough for SC, but not for Texas. I mean, he wasn't that big. But anyway, I can't help it. I just can't help it, okay? I asked the worship team to close in the eyes of Texas, and I couldn't convince them. But anyway, the big guy says to the little guy, now here we are, most important political moment in the history of the world. Little guy's about to sign. No one said anything. Big guy in the back of the room says, I shall have a great advantage over you, Mr. Gerry, when we're hung for what we're now doing. He said, by the size and great weight of my body, well, I'll be dead within a minute or two. By the lightness of yours, you're going to dance in the air for an hour or more before you're dead. True story, all right? That's the only word spoken during the signing of our Declaration of Independence. So I tell you that, though. I think it's a funny story, but I tell you that because I think that really drives home the fact that those guys knew what they were doing. They knew it was a death sentence. They knew this was it. When they put their name on the dotted line, King George was coming after them. Yet they were willing to follow through. They didn't just get excited. I mean, these guys were patriots. They were sinners, just like you and I, but they were patriots because they didn't just get excited, sign the petition, go home. They followed through. History says not one of those 56 backed down. Watched their homes go up in smoke, watched their sons die in the war, millionaires died in debtor's prison later because they gave every penny that they had. 9 didn't survive to enjoy the freedom you and I have. I mean, they made the sacrifices, lives, fortunes, and sacred honor so that you and I could be free. Study their stories. Get that book, that old textbook, Lives of the Signers, that documents each of their lives and tells you about their faith and the sacrifice that they made. Let's you and I do what we need to do to continue that heritage that they gave us. Now, part of that doesn't mean you have to give all of your life or all of your fortune or all of your sacred honor, but in living out your freedom, you give a little bit of your life. That means your time, whether it's to go vote or volunteer, whatever it is. fortunes, a little bit of your money, contributing to groups like Alliance Defense Fund and those kind of folks that are fighting those battles for us, defending our religious liberties, contributing to candidates that will support these things and help to preserve our nation. Sacred honor, you write that letter to the editor. You go to that school board meeting and speak out. And I promise you, people are going to say things about you you don't like. That's what they mean by that sacred honor. Lives, fortunes, and sacred honor. Live your freedom. I'm not asking you to die for freedom, though I think most people in this room would say, if I was called upon, I'd die for freedom so my kids could enjoy it. I'm not asking you to do that. I'm asking you to live the freedom that others have died to secure for you and I. Make sure you participate. President Garfield put it this way. He said, now more than ever before, the people are responsible for the character of their Congress. If that body be ignorant, reckless, and corrupt, it's because the people tolerate ignorance, recklessness, and corruption. If it be intelligent, brave, and pure, it's because the people demand these high qualities to represent them in the national legislature. If the next centennial does not find us a great nation, it's because the people who represent the enterprise, the culture, and the morality of the nation, that's us, because we do not aid in controlling the political forces. That's consent of the governed, folks. That's you and I being willing to stand up and say, I give my consent or I refuse my consent. Let's participate in this thing. Let's make sure that we're voting. I know Jack does a great job of getting you involved. Y'all have no idea, well, maybe you do, how blessed you are to have a pastor that's like a man of Issachar. He understands the times and knows what to do. I'm against cloning, but if we could clone Jack, I might change my mind, all right? But make sure you're voting. If you don't think your vote counts, you might remember my story from a few years ago. On election night in 98, I lost by 20 votes out of 30,000. 20 votes, folks. Now, I don't know about around here, back in Texas. I mean, that's one decent-sized homeschool family. That's not, it's just not a lot of folks, all right? We homeschool with four, and all my friends say, that's a nice start you got going there. So anyway, you can get 20 votes for the candidate of your choice, all right? The guy standing next to me on election night when we're told 20 votes, he says, man, 20 votes? He says, I could have got you 20 more votes. That's when you want to lay hands on somebody without prayer. You know, that was not the time to tell me that. We did have a recount and found a few hanging chads there and ended up winning by 36 votes. Now, this was 1998. Of course, 2000 was when everybody else learned what a hanging chad was when Florida came in. But in 98, 2 years before that, I got this great call after we won. And as the governor of Texas at the time, George W. Bush. And he says, Rick, he says, you did it the hard way, recounting everything. He said, I'm officially dubbing you Landslide Green. Which he thought was funny in 1998. Not so funny in 2000, all right, all the rest of us learned one. But anyway, all that to say, your vote counts. Make sure your values are counted, that your voice is heard. Show up and vote, whatever the election. Obviously, this presidential election this year is huge. Make sure that you study those candidates. You got three left. Two of them support partial birth abortion and gay marriage. One of them does not. Go study and find out which one you can support. Volunteer for candidates. Contribute to candidates. Speak out. Every one of us has a realm of influence, not just in who's running for office, but what's going on in the culture. Study David Barton's book, Original Intent, so you're ready, whether you're at the coffee shop or the Little League field or the water fountain at work, wherever, and the subject comes up. Maybe it's separation of church and state or whatever. You've got to be equipped with the truth of our nation so you can influence that one person and the next and the next. Listen to Wall Builders Live so you can be encouraged. We do Good News Friday every week just to talk about all the victories we've got. We're winning legislative battles, judicial battles, good people getting elected, good things happening in the culture, people making a difference in their local school district. All these great things are happening, and it's because people like you are getting involved, and it's just good to be encouraged. So tune in there and get a heads up on what's happening around the country. And one thing I want to leave you with before I close is passing the torch, making sure that your kids get it, that the young people in this church get it, that they understand the value of what they've got, instill these things in them. And we want to help you raise up the next generation of leadership. We do a program, Wall Builders does, called Patriot Academy there in Austin, Texas. We bring in 16 to 25 year olds from all around the country, and they come in and serve as a legislator for a week. We teach them speaking skills, media skills, a biblical worldview of government, all these things. And I mean, we even allow kids from the Northeast to come to this thing. And their program's a little different. They spend the first day learning how to talk right. And if they get the accent down, then we let them get into policy. But anyway, It's a great program. It's our way of helping you. And actually, Ashley Franks, one of our graduates, resident of California here, graduate of Patriot Academy, will be at the table and glad to visit with anybody that's interested in the program. Encourage you to go talk to her. But it's a great program. We want to help you raise up that generation. Now let me close with a story that I think fits where maybe a lot of us are right now, because it's easy to get frustrated in this process. I remember when I first got in the legislature, man, I wanted every bill. I wanted to pass it overnight. I wasn't very good at this long-term game. I mean, I wanted things to happen immediately. I'm a little bit type A. My wife says I'm type AAA, but I mean, I'm ready to do things now. Anyway, I began to realize that this kind of stuff doesn't happen overnight, and we have to do our duty regardless of what the results are. And there's a great story out of our history that really puts this in motion. And I know some of you might be frustrated. You might say, well, yeah, I got involved. I got people elected. Nothing changed. A lot has changed, but maybe we didn't get everything that we wanted. Christians in this country, in 2000, only 1 out of 4 of us voted. In 2004, 2 out of 4. So we were at half. 2006, we went back down to 1 out of 3. So we kind of stayed home because we didn't get everything we wanted overnight. So we've got to stop, you know, being fickle like that. We've got to show up in mass, and we've got to do our duty every day, come back day after day, week after week, month after month. Here's the example I want to share with you. John Quincy Adams, he was president of the United States. I know I'm a little bit over here. I'm circling. Doesn't mean I'm landing, but it means I could land at any time. So be ready. Okay. John Quincy Adams was obviously president of the United States. But then after serving as president, only got to do this. After being president, he goes home and he runs for Congress. Now, today that'd be like, you know, being the man down there at the one end of Pennsylvania, one of one, and then going down to being one of 535. All right, you got to have some humility and be willing to serve. That's what he had. He had one purpose in mind. What was his one issue? Anybody know? Slavery. He wanted to end slavery. Pro-slavery Congress. I mean, this is like David versus Goliath. He was our William Wilberforce. He came in every week. He filed petition after petition, bill after bill, saying he wanted to get rid of slavery. Brought the petitions from all over the country. The pro-slavery Congress got so sick, they nicknamed him the Hellhound of Slavery. They got so tired of listening to him trying to get rid of slavery, they passed the John Quincy Adams gag order. They said, you can talk about anything you want, John Quincy Adams, but not slavery. We're tired of hearing about it. He just keeps coming back week after week, month after month. 13 years of this, a reporter comes to him and says, hey, what are you doing? I mean, what's the point? You're not getting anywhere. You haven't accomplished anything. You haven't moved the agenda forward at all. You know what John Quincy Adams said? He said, duty is ours. Results are God's. He said, I'm just doing my part. God's going to take care of the results. If I get to see those results, great. If I don't, that's fine. Did he get to see an end to slavery? No. 4 years later, he dies in Congress, right there on the floor of Congress. 17 years he fought, and he didn't get to see the results. For 1 2-year term, he served with a young man that came in, served those 2 years, became such good friends with John Quincy Adams. Adams became like a mentor to him, kind of brain dump into him. They were so close, the kid was a pallbearer at Adams' funeral. Kid goes home to run for re-election, loses. Loses again the next go around. Runs for another office and loses. Another office and loses. Another office and loses. Finally, almost 20 years later, he wins another election. You're already up there with me, aren't you? President of the United States, Abraham Lincoln, implements the same plan John Quincy Adams had been trying to do for 17 years. Folks, we have no idea who we're going to pass that torch to. We have no idea who's going to come along after we planted the seeds, and they're going to come along and water those seeds. I would love to see an end to abortion here in America in my lifetime. But you know what? Even if we don't, that doesn't mean we don't fight day after day, do our duty, make sure that we're passing that torch to the next generation. And I want to tell you, I'm so encouraged. I get to watch these young people at Patriot Academy. They get it. They understand the times. They know what to do. They're passionate. They're articulate. They're more pro-life than the last 3 generations. I mean, it is very encouraging. I think we're going to be passing the torch to a group of folks, a generation that's going to accomplish a lot of the things that we're fighting for. But all of that to say, I hope that you will do your part in participating in this thing and continue. Don't give up because you don't get the results that you want. Know that God is going to take care of those results. It's our responsibility to do our part and then let God take care of whatever those results are going to be. I appreciate you so much having us back. I hope that you'll look at some of those Wall Builders things and learn these things and commit them to memory so you can influence the people that you get to spend time with. We're so blessed in this country. We're so blessed as a generation to have the opportunity to stand guard at the watchtower of freedom. Let's make sure history's chapter on us is not one where they say on our watch the torch was only dimly lit or God forbid it was extinguished. Let you and I do whatever God's called each of us to do and make sure that God's history's chapter on us is one where they say that on our watch, that torch of freedom, it burned even brighter. than it ever had before. Thanks for letting this Texan be with you today. God bless you guys. Hey, brother. Hey, let's see.